This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location. It is virtual reality. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Carolyn Forché is here. She's one of America's most valued poets and certainly one of the most loved. Her new memoir was called a masterpiece by New Yorker Magazine this year, and it is fascinating, historical, action-adventure, lyrical, terrifying, the best of the genre. Carolyn, hello. Thank you for coming.
Hello, Grace. Thank you for having me.
What is the title of this fascinating work, and can you sum it up for us?
It's called What You Have Heard Is True, a memoir of witness and resistance. It takes place during the years when I was 27, 28, 29 years old. There was a period in which I traveled to Spain, translated the poet Claribel Alegría, and was subsequently invited by her cousin to travel to El Salvador. Prior to the war, there was a civil war there for 12 years, and I went before the war started. And he took me on an educational journey that was transformative in every way in my life. And what I tried to do in this book was to take the reader on that same journey. So as one reads, you never know more than I knew at the time. And the whole thing was a great mystery that unfolded for me. And it was extraordinary and absolutely changed my life.
Oh, Carolyn, I cannot tell you how I agree with what you've said, because I really only stopped to eat and sleep while I read this memoir, because it is as if it's happening at the moment. It is the immediacy. It's not like you telling us a story. We are with you. How did you learn the structure of a novel? How?
Well, it was very difficult. It took me 15 years to write it because I wrote three other versions I wasn't happy with until I discovered this one. And I realized what I really wanted to do was to lead the reader on the same journey. And once I knew that, the voice came and that was it.
I can only imagine, from gathering all those little pieces of fractured notes under fire, stepping over corpses, well, that all of those images that you saved in your notebook, how they ever got put together. I think you had divine help. You had to have help. This was a masterful piece. And I think the big piece in the New Yorker magazine can still be found this year. And it explains much more about the memoir than we can. But we can try our best to poke into it. So you say it took 15 years in the making. Mm-hmm. And we know your poems about El Salvador. They have taken the world by the lapels ever since you've written these books. But this is a context for those wounds. Yeah. Somehow the memoir makes all of the framing necessary for everything you've ever written. So I find it is one of the most important books of certainly this decade, many decades, and I want to get it in as many hands as possible. So we're going to hear a little bit about this. This was, I want everyone to know, this journey for Carolyn Forché started in 1977. So this was quite a long time ago. Do you remember the girl that did this?
I had to remember her to tell the story, but I wanted to be as true as possible to the person I was at that time, to that young woman, and with all of her flaws, so her stubbornness and her lack of judgment, I had to include everything. So I re-inhabited myself from that time.
Yeah. That must have been very difficult, though, to live it once and then to live it twice. Did you write it in stints? For instance, did you write things in between this memoir, or did you say every morning from 8 to 9, I'm going to do this?
I had, over the 15 years, I had two interruptions, one for illness and one for destruction of my house. So I had pauses. I tried to write as much as I could, But I would say it was more like assembling a jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. I would write the various pieces and then assemble them. And sometimes it felt like assembling a jigsaw puzzle backwards so that you don't get to see the image until you're finished. So,
well, it has been called a literary masterpiece. And so that can't make you feel too bad. Whatever you did must have worked putting those pieces together. I can imagine that it was extremely difficult, and yet it could have been cleansing as well. I want everyone to know a little bit about you before we hear from the book. And Carolyn Forché most recently did teach in the graduate MFA program at George Mason University and now is a professor at Georgetown. She was the director of Lannan Center for Poetics and Social Practice and held the Lannan Visiting Chair in Poetry at Georgetown. She's co-chair with Gloria Steinem, a residency for women writers on Whidbey Island. And she lives in Maryland with her husband, Harry Madison, a photographer, whom she married in 1984, and has a son, Sean Christoph Madison. So now that we know who you are, those of us, people have been calling me all day saying, when are we going to hear this? Really, people are waiting to hear you. So let us hear a page of this memoir.
Okay. I had a friend there named Margarita, and Margarita and I began working together, and we became very close. I will read a passage about something that happened to us one night. That evening, we'd planned to meet with some of Margarita's friends and a few European journalists who had arrived in the country several weeks earlier. We would listen to reports of what they had seen, and we would tell them what we knew. There would be Coca-Cola and potato chips. We were still in the clothes we had chosen that morning, so yes, we did look bourgeois, but I would never have been able to run in those shoes. I could barely walk in them. Margarita pulled out of the parking lot onto what I would call a slip road, narrow and unlit, a road that wound around La UCA, the university. She was still laughing and teasing me when suddenly, and in a grave voice, she said my name, and the car was flooded with light. Mm. She pressed the accelerator to the floor. The vehicle behind us was following so closely that a person could have leaped from one roof to the other. Margarita sped into a tunnel of darkness ahead, and the vehicle behind us sped too. Escuadrón de la Muerte, she said. It is the death squad, Carolyn. They're going to capture us. I turned around to watch the other car, but couldn't see it for the light. Margarita, I remember calling out, can you go faster? No, Carolyn, I cannot. This is as fast as I can go, and I think I am lost. There is the city ahead of us. Drive toward the lights. We sped. The other car sped too. This was going to be it, I thought. Now, when it wasn't expected, after a day of talking about philosophy and God and the practice of liberation, I wanted to be brave. I did not feel brave. I had no weapon. It would not have helped. There was no last chance to do anything over again. Are you afraid, Margarita? Yes. They were still behind us when we reached a heavier trafficked road, behind us when we got to the roundabout, and that was where the honking began. Other cars whose drivers saw what was happening, other cars pulling into the roundabout, slowing down, blocking the way of those who followed us, and all the while horns honking and even some cars stopping and people getting out of the cars, and then there was an opening and we took it. All the way to the house of the friends of Margarita, we didn't breathe. And then the door was opening, and we ran through it from the front of the house to the garden in the back where the journalists were standing around in the dark.
That is the voice of Carolyn Forché, and it is a piece from her memoir where she is in El Salvador on the brink of a war, a full-blown war, a civil war, revolution. She is smack in the middle of it. And so I just want to tell people where you were before then. Here's this nice Catholic girl from Michigan, who's, I believe, in Mallorca, translating Clarabel Alegría. And Clarabel's uncle or nephew or cousin?
It's a cousin. I learned that. Her mother and his mother were sisters.
Okay. So. She's, of course, a great poet. And you were translating her on sabbatical, I guess. So in comes Leonel Vidas, and he asks you to come to El Salvador because he wants the eyes and the ears of a poet to see what's happening there. Well, what were you thinking? I mean, really, Carolyn? Here you are in your sundress in the sun having tea, and you go with this man because you know his family into the brink of war. Was this recklessness? Was it Dorothy Day? Was it courage? What was the moment of thought when you followed him? Can you find that moment that triggered your action?
Well, you know, he spent 3 days with his daughters at my house.
Right.
And he spent those days talking. And in those 3 days, he asked me a question that was really important that no one had ever asked me before. Mm. People had asked what I wanted to be when I would grow up and all of that. But he said, what is your plan for what you are going to do for the rest of humanity during your life?
Wow.
And no one had ever asked me that. He also told me he could recreate a Peace Corps experience, and I had always wanted to join the Peace Corps. And I'd just been given a Guggenheim grant. I had no excuses, and I realized he was holding a door open for me. And if I could walk through it, or I could decline. And if I said no, I could never tell myself that I would have done such a thing if I'd only had the chance. I realized this was my chance.
There has to be some courage in your DNA from your own lineage to do this. But I was a wreck every page because I knew who you were always my whole life in poetry. Mm-hmm. And I kept seeing Carolyn Forché doing this, you know, not a character in nonfiction. And here you are watching shacks burn down, being left in houses with people you didn't know overnight, no electricity, no bathrooms. Eating dry tortillas and beans, stepping, you know, being in a dictator's home, not knowing if you're going to get out alive. This is Carolyn Forché. This is not a fictional character. And I could always picture you doing these things. You know, I'm only glad you had to do one day at a time. I don't think people understand that you were there at the brink of a complete civil war, and you were right in the midst of it. This little girl from Michigan, this poet, he wanted a poet's sensibilities. What do you make of that?
Well, he believed that poets reached hearts. He believed that there was a special language and a special kind of perception that poets practiced and a certain kind of attention. And so he wanted to educate a poet so that when the war began, that poet could come to the United States, return to the United States and explain what was going on to her countrymen. However, I explained to him that, you know, poets don't have opportunities to do that in the United States, that poets were not given great visibility in our culture. And so his solution to that was to tell me I had to change that. I had to make poets important somehow.
And guess what? He was a prophet. And you did take that home, and you did wake us up to El Salvador. And nobody would even have been interested because our country wasn't geared that way. So
no.
I think of you, all of those things. Was there some sort of effect on you after you returned? I mean, did it take you a while to resume to normal?
I think that for a long time, I didn't realize that I had crossed over in my life into another mode of being almost. Mm-hmm. I had been educated, my eyes had been open, but I also realized years later that I had been traumatized.
And wow.
So much of how I felt and lived in the aftermath was marked by that trauma. And I recognize now in myself, you know, a certain obsessiveness. I traveled all over the country talking obsessively about El Salvador, trying to get people interested and things like that. I mean, I could, and it took years to process this. And that's in part why I waited so long to even begin writing. I waited 23 years to even start this.
Yes.
Because, well, for one thing, you're right. I didn't want to relive it. It was frightening to relive. But also, I wanted perspective. I wanted to come to some understanding about what had happened. I never really reached that point. And finally, it was Ilya Kaminsky, the poet, who told me, you know, it was time, that I wasn't getting any younger and that I should begin, I should write it, whether I was ready or not.
Well, you brought the world to its heels. Are you the one who gave us the phrase poetry of witness?
Well, I had been in conversation with the late Terence Dupré for several years about his book, The Survivor, An Anatomy of Life in the Death Camps. And I just began applying what he conceptualized witness, and I began thinking about it for poets. And I was interested in what poets wrote in the aftermath of an experience of extremity. And I began to realize that that was the mark of witness in their art. And I wanted to read for that mark and attempt to enter their poems in the light of what they had done. So I wrote an essay for American Poetry Review in 1981, and I used that phrase.
Yes.
And a few years later, Czesław Miłosz wrote a wonderful book called, published a book called The Witness of Poetry. And, you know, and then I was working all that time on the anthology Against Forgetting, trying to collect this work together, work that I imagined could be called poetry of witness. And so I suppose, yes, although it was somewhat perhaps in the air too.
Well, you have been awakened and you have enlightened us. And you talk about it in very colloquial terms, how you learned to see as you drove down the roads. And you said that for one time you only saw fields. And as you began to look, you actually saw what was happening in those fields. And it was like something was being unveiled to you. And therefore, all of your writing unveils that to us. The art of seeing. I think the trauma was worth that enlightening. I think what happened to you, for you to bring back that baton of light, was a significant thing.
Thank you. I hope so. I think the whole thing was an education in seeing. When I first arrived in El Salvador, I think I had the eyes very much of a tourist, of someone who felt very much apart from her surroundings and judge things to be lovely that were actually excruciating, like women carrying water jugs so gracefully along the roads, not realizing that they weighed 80 pounds and that they were caused compression of the spine. And why they were carrying the water jugs was because they had no potable water. You know, it took me a long time to understand what I was seeing and to look more carefully. And that's what Leonel taught me.
And you also even went into a prison, saw prisoners in boxes, held in boxes. You have seen corpses. You were given a very strong education. Now, the piece you read about Marguerite, was that in El Salvador?
Yes. Margarita and I were at the university, the Jesuit university, La UCA Catholic University. We had been there all day meeting with Jesuit priests, the priests who were murdered in November of 1989.
Was that San Salvador? Was it in the capital?
Yes, it was in San Salvador in the capital.
Yes.
And we had been meeting with the Jesuits and talking, and it was a very unusually light, joyful day. And we had planned to meet with a journalist that night. And that was the context for that passage.
Well, let us hear another bit of this memoir and give us the title so we will never forget it.
It's called What You Have Heard Is True, A Memoir of Witness and Resistance. When I was in El Salvador, I became very ill. So I'm going to read a passage that actually takes place in a hospital. It's very hard to isolate passages to read from this because it's all one long narrative. But I awoke lying on a bed of ice, like a fish or a corpse, a window flickering day, then night, then day. A few turkey vultures curled their talons around the bed rails, one of them hopping onto my stomach, and even though I recognized their red masks and their hissing, I knew they weren't actually there, these belching oil-colored birds. they could not be. Saline dripped through a tube from a glass bottle inverted over the bed. Silver. My arm was taped to a splint, a spot of blood on the tape. My other wrist was fastened with gauze to the opposite bed rail. I had pulled the needle out more than once, as even I could remember. I had been delirante, or whatever it was, crazy, unable to make myself understood, and I had nothing left, I knew that. Everything I had was in the toilet or in the basins, but the fever was not out. My bones were still on fire, and the fire was also in my head, burning behind my eyes. I couldn't think, and there was some confusion about who was in the room and who wasn't, and how long it had been, and why. In the darkness, Lionel had talked to me about jaguars. Why there is a jaguar on my woven bag. Why he had given me a small weaving of a jaguar on a torn piece of cloth. He sometimes also called them wildcats. "You are a wildcat, Papu," he said. "You just don't know it that know it yet. That is why I gave you these things. The wildcat can camouflage itself. It can hide anywhere. It doesn't roar like the other great cats. It is solitary and nocturnal and can adapt to many environments. The Mayans call it Balam. Certain humans have jaguar characteristics. They help with communication between the living and the dead. They are said to be extinct in El Salvador, but they are not. Someday you will understand why I'm telling you this."
The beautiful prose, just how to make horror beautiful is to say it clearly. And of course, as a child, you were breeding yourself on meter. As a little kid, you used to write meter.
Yes.
And you know, that's inherent in the line. There's nothing like prose from a poet. Mm. Nothing like prose from a poet. Now, I just want everyone to know that this occurred in 77 and 78, right?
The work largely begins in 1977 in the autumn, and it largely ends in March of 1980.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then you actually met your husband, the photographer, and he was from Time magazine in South Africa. Do I have that?
No, he was, he later went to South Africa. We both did. But we met in a makeshift refugee camp in the capital, close to the end of my time there. And that was the first time we met, and we didn't really talk to each other on that day. And then we met 3 years later in New York.
Oh, mm-hmm. There, you know, the movie is shaping up right in front of my eyes. And then you had this wonderful son, Jean-Christophe, and moved where after that?
When I returned from El Salvador, I traveled the country talking about the pending war and then talking about the war itself. And then I re-met Harry when I was invited to come to New York to write a text for a book of photographs called El Salvador Work of 30 Photographers. So we then, we got together very quickly and we went to Beirut, Lebanon, and then to South Africa. Sean was born in France in 1986, and we returned to the United States in 1987, and then traveled around the country until we finally settled into jobs in the United States.
And what is the title of this memoir? Where did you get the title? It sounds familiar.
The title was suggested by my husband, and it is the first line of the poem The Colonel, which is rather notorious poem from my book, The Country Between Us. So that poem begins, "What you have heard is true. I was in his house." And my husband just said, "Why don't you call it What You Have Heard is True?"
Perfect for that. Perfect. And that poem is a very famous poem. Everyone who knows your name knows that poem, I'm sure. I'm going to make sure that everyone I know has this book, and everyone that they know has this book.
Thank you.
It is the book of the decade. And it is certainly something I really believe in, Karen.
Thank you.
We're going to shift gears for a minute. You've already earned five doctorates, honorary doctors from five different universities.
Not earned, honorary, yes. I didn't earn them. I was just giving them like prizes.
That's, I think, well earned perhaps, but they were earned prizes. But now we have a PhD just won this year from your scholarship. Mm-hmm. Tell us how that happened and what is it about? Is it a literature PhD?
I had always wanted to earn a PhD, and I had thought all my life I would, and in my mid-60s, I was spending some visiting time at the University of Newcastle in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, England, and I discovered that I could actually study for my PhD there under the direction of two poets, Linda Anderson, who was an Elizabeth Bishop scholar, and the poet Sean O'Brien. And so I spent the next 3 or 4 years working on my doctorate with them. And it's in a British degree, and it's in creative writing. And I wrote my dissertation on mnemonic poetics, the role of the notebook in the work of poets. And it was a very interesting exploration of the casual small notebooks that are kept in the pockets of poets as part of their daily writing habit. And we often look at those notebooks when we're doing scholarship on poetry, especially in the 20th century, but almost no one ever thinks about them as objects in their own right or as having a role in the poetic process. So that's what I wrote about.
Well, that book will be published, right?
I hope so. If a publisher would like it, I'm happy to work it into a book that is less meticulously made as a work of scholarship. I would write it for a general audience, but yes.
Well, there's nothing that exists like it, so no. That's one reason to publish. And I think everyone would be very interested in it. I certainly would. I have a little notebook myself. Now, from scholarship and nonfiction, we look at you as a poet, who you are, and your latest book is called what?
The poetry book is called In the Lateness of the World, which is a title taken from a Robert Duncan poem. And it was a book that I wrote over a period of 17 years. I wrote it concurrently with the memoir, and it came very slowly and in fits and starts. And when the memoir, they were both accepted together by my editor at Penguin Press, Christopher Richards. And Christopher wanted to publish the memoir first and the poetry book the following year. So the poetry book waited for a long time for me to finish the memoir. And it was fortuitous because I was able to write several newer poems by the time it was being prepared for publication. But it was 17 years since my last book, which is rather a very long time, I think.
You're a careful writer. You're a thoughtful writer. You're not a showboat. You actually, when a book comes out from you, it is a book. And Hilton Owls in The New Yorker said that this is about action, memory as action, vision, and writing as action. I think it is an accumulation of all the themes in your other work. What do you think?
I think so too. It feels like a culmination of a period of my life that was decades long. And I feel that the poems are in conversation with each other. There are motifs and images that occur and recur. It's sort of a more or less a mosaic of a consciousness, I feel.
Yes, that is a good way to say it. And so therefore you'll give us a poem, please.
Yes, this one is called The Museum of Stones. It was written for a friend who always picked stones up from the ground wherever he traveled in the world and assembled them into a private museum. He didn't want souvenirs, he wanted the little stones. Museum of Stones. These are your stones, assembled in matchbox and tin, collected from roadside, culvert and viaduct, battlefield threshing floor, basilica abattoir. Stones loosened by tanks in the streets, from a city whose earliest map was drawn in ink on linen. Schoolyard stones in the hand of a corpse. Pebble from Baudelaire's We. Stone of the mind within us. carried from one silence to another. Stone of cromlech and cairn, schist and shale, hornblende, agate, marble, millstones, ruins of choirs and shipyards, chalk, marl, mudstone from temples and tombs, stone from the silvery grass near the scaffold, stone from the tunnel lined with bones, lava of a city's entombment, stones chipped from lighthouse, cell wall, scriptorium, paving stones from the hands of those who rose against the army, stones where the bells had fallen, where the bridges were blown. Those that had flown through windows, weighted petitions, feldspar, rose quartz, blue schist, gneiss, and chert, fragments of an abbey at dusk, sandstone toe of a Buddha mortared at Bamiyan, stone from the hill of three crosses and a crypt, from a chimney where storks cried like human children, stones newly fallen from stars, a stillness of stones, a heart, altar and boundary stone, marker and vessel, first cast, load and hail, bridge stones and others to pave and shut up with, stone apple, stone basil, beech berry, stone break, concretion of the body, as blind, as cold, as deaf, all earth a quarry, all life a labor, stone-faced, stone-drunk with hope that this assemblage of rubble taken together would become a shrine or holy place, an ossuary, immovable and sacred, like the stone that marked the path of the sun as it entered the human dawn.
That is from your new book of poems. The line came to me just now, that was the day I became mortal.
Oh, yes.
Of course, it was about the birth of your son.
Mm-hmm.
But that resonance, that vibration, that feeling that flooded my body was just like that last line of your poem. Tell us the last line of the poem you just read.
It likened like the stone that marked the path of the sun as it entered the human dawn. And that,
yes,
that image is reflected later in the book because it's an image of the passage tombs of Ireland, where on the solstice, our time of year now, the sun enters a chamber for 17 minutes and floods it with light. And that was a chamber built in the Neolithic period.
Give us the title of the book one more time and then read us a final poem.
Okay, it's called In the Lateness of the World. And the poem I'll read is The Light Keeper, which is both about lighthouses and not about lighthouses, but it includes a little bit of the history of their lights. The Light Keeper. A night without ships. Foghorns calling into walled cloud. And you, still alive, drawn to the light, as if it were a fire kept by monks. Darkness once crusted with stars, but now death dark as you sail inward. Through wild gorse and sea wrack, through heather and torn wool you ran, pulling me by the hand so I might see this for once in my life. The spin and spin of light, the whirring of it, light in search of the lost, there, since the era of fire, era of candles and hollow wick lamps, whale oil and solid wick, colza and lard, kerosene and carbide, the signal fires lighted on this perilous coast in the Tower of Hook. You say to me, stay awake. Be like the lens maker who died with his lungs full of glass. Be the yew in blossom when bees swarm. Be their amber cathedral. And even the ghosts of Cistercians will be kind to you. In a certain light, as after rain, in pearled clouds or the water beyond, seen or sensed water, sea or lake, you would stop still and gaze out for a long time. Also, when fireflies opened and closed in the pines and a star appeared, our only heaven, you taught me to live like this.
Oh.
That after death, it would be as it was before we were born. Nothing to be afraid. Nothing but happiness, as unbearable as the dread from which it comes. Go toward the light always. Be without ships.
That is the voice of Carolyn Forché, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. It is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and additional support by the Sinipet Fund and Diane Wilbon Parks. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.